opinions expressed do not reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, everyone. We'll be speaking today about evolution. And on the phone with us is Dr. Greg Layden. Hello, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thank you. And we'll be taking all of our listeners' thoughtful and challenging questions shortly. And first, I actually just want to share a story with you guys. I went to the Imagining Science exhibit last weekend, and it was lovely. And it was actually science-inspired art. It was brilliant, actually, but you can't go because the exhibit is down now. My apologies. But I went to a psychic after the show.
Was it everything you dreamed of and more?
Oh, everything. Everything.
What did they tell you? Was it a lady or a man?
It was a lady. I went to the Russian tea room, and they have sort of a stable of psychics at the back of the restaurant. And so I went to the one, and she started talking about, you know, my partner and the obstacles.
Me?
That were, she didn't specify, you know what? Maybe that's what she was
Keep
talking
going.
About. Because she was talking about the obstacles that we're facing right now. And one of them about, she mentioned the fact that I feel like I'm being controlled. And she did say
Stop
it would
talking.
Get
Just
better.
Kidding.
And that would be great news if I had a partner, which I don't. Actually, it was really funny because she also wouldn't assign a gender to this partner. She very much couldn't figure out if I was straight or gay. It was very cute. I'm a little bit butchy, I have to say. We were talking about how I must work in the arts, which I absolutely don't. But I was wearing all black with a poofy cream scarf. And I suppose I looked very artistic. Anyway, it was lovely because when I had gone in, I had decided that I wouldn't give her any verbal responses. So it would, and I would try not to give her any nonverbal responses either. So I spent the entire thing just sort of saying like, and that's it. But without actually like acknowledging that she had spoke, but not actually.
Was that difficult? Because it can be hard not to, even if you're skeptical,
there was,
to not feel you should. You
exactly.
Know.
Because it's that human connection. You want to encourage somebody to speak. Absolutely. And I think speaking about that arts thing. Something must have showed in my face that I didn't work in the arts, because right away she said, well, that's interesting. You work in a creative field, someplace where you can use your creativity. Anyway, I had her sweating bullets by the end, to tell you the truth, because she really didn't know where to go with it. She looked very twitchy.
Wow.
So it was, yeah. Anyway, that was a brilliant use of $22.
Was she older, or? I just would say that to wonder how experienced she was, which doesn't necessarily.
Definitely in her 50s.
Okay.
Nice lady. Absolutely nice lady. Anyway, on to the interview. In honor of Darwin Day, which is February 12th, we are talking about evolution today. So thanks again, Greg, for being with us.
Glad to be here. I was wondering if you considered the possibility that the fact that you obviously don't believe that this psychic was going to work caused a kind of confirmation bias, so it didn't actually work.
Interesting. That could. I'm thinking that cold readers are very experienced in how to read their subjects. So although it could be confirmation bias on my part, mm-hmm. I also think that looking at what I was wearing that day and the sort of the nonverbal cues that I gave off unwillingly, I think that if she's psychic, she's a very poor psychic.
Mm-hmm.
And if she's not psychic, I think cold reading probably explains what she did.
Yeah.
If you have an opinion on psychics, bring it.
Right.
So a bit of background on Dr. Layden. Before appearing on Q Transmissions tonight, which will undoubtedly be the high point of his life, he went to a little school called Harvard, and where he got his PhD in biological anthropology and archaeology. So what are you up to these days, Greg?
I just want to say it wasn't really my fault that I went to Harvard. I just happened to have a job there because there was a job there. And when it came time for me to go to graduate school, because I lost my job because the part of the university I worked for closed down, I was already there. It was just easier to just stay in place. The inertia was good. So What was your question?
why do you hate Harvard?
Why do you believe
that's,
this?
That is the new question.
I don't hate Harvard at all. It's actually a great place. It's just that it's the kind of place where people can say, oh, I went to the University of Wisconsin or I went to whatever, McGill, and people are just, well, whatever. But if you say Harvard, because you did go there, then people assume you're being pretentious. But I can't help that I went there. I can't pretend. I had a job for a while. I needed to get a job in order to get unemployment or something, and I was still a graduate student. And I was working for this inventory specialist where you go into stores and count every single thing and add it up. It was really kind of a difficult job. And it was over the holidays, and somebody said, people were talking about where they were going to school and stuff, and I mentioned I went to Harvard. And they all assumed, this is in Albany, New York, they all assumed that I went to Hudson Valley Community College because it's locally known as the Harvard on the Hudson. Anyway, it just brings so much baggage with it, that's all.
But
it's a good school.
That's just interesting. This is possibly the first time I've ever heard somebody try and minimize going to Harvard.
Right.
Okay. So,
you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
So how did evolution get to be such a topic of interest for you?
Oh, yeah. Okay, good question. For me, when I was at Harvard working there, I was actually doing archaeology. I was doing Native American and historic archaeology of the Boston area and generally around New England. And I was always, since I was a kid, interested in science, especially biology. But I've been working for years as an archaeologist, and that was my area. But I wasn't even actually a bone guy. I was a stone tool and pottery expert, and not so much a bone expert. So I really wasn't even involved that much in biology. And as I said, the place I worked closed, so I decided that maybe I would go into graduate school. And I took a summer school class in human evolution taught by David Kilbeam, and because it was available, it was, again, it was across the street, and it was something I could easily do, as far as the logistics of it were, and it was available and so on. So I just took the class in human evolution, and it was an intro class in human evolution. I had never taken a college class on evolutionary biology or anything like this before, and I decided by the end of the class that I was really interested in it, and instead of going into graduate school to study North American archaeology, I went into graduate school to study bioanthropology. Because it's one class, which is so interesting.
Humble beginnings.
Yeah.
You seem to have a lot of interest in this. So, for example, on your blog, the aptly titled Greg Layden's blog, you have a series about Darwin that you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, I it's funny that people who are a large number of people who are evolutionary biologists actually have read very little Darwin, and it's kind of a thing people don't admit. They don't admit. Everyone sort of pretends, oh, yeah, I read The Origin or whatever. And I had read what I was supposed to read in school, and I've taught a little bit of class in which I, assigned Darwin. So I had some exposure, but a few years ago I decided to read, most of it. And I found it really engaging and interesting. So when I started blogging, I started writing about Darwin's writings, because I'm trying to encourage people to read them. And it turns out that, one of the best books I've ever read is The Voyage of the Beagle. It's basically his field notes turned into a narrative memoir after the fact. And it has an interesting and kind of actually a boring and complicated publication history. But we now know of this manuscript as The Voyage of the Beagle. And in it you see, you learn all these things about Darwin. Everyone assumes that Darwin was a biologist, but he wasn't. He was a geologist, and he also was a biologist. But to him, geology was his main interest. And people often assume that he figured out, natural selection when he, was exposed to the finches and the tortoises on the Galapagos. But in fact, he didn't quite. Actually, he completely screwed up the finches. He had all the birds classified wrong. He wasn't really a bird expert. He knew about the British birds, but not about the Galapagos birds. So his formative, insightful major changes in how he thinks about things and what he learns and what makes him end up being Charles Darwin is actually all about coral reefs and some interesting geological problems that he encountered as far as his travels in mainly in South America on the Beagle. And, it's just an interesting story that tells you Charles Darwin's not a one-dimensional character. He's not the guy who came up with the basic theory of natural selection, and that's pretty much it. He rather was a person who encountered so many different areas of science and had a huge encyclopedic knowledge, and ended up, in a very humble way, having a huge impact on the intelligentsia community of Cambridge in Britain after that voyage. That you can understand how that all happens by reading this one book. I think you hear him talking about everything he encounters, and he was an ethnographer, he was a geologist, he was interested in all different sorts of things. So I've written a series of very short vignettes, just a little bit of exposure here and there. Just read five paragraphs here, just read three paragraphs there, and a little bit of commentary on from that one volume.
That's a great idea. Are a lot of people reading it?
That's actually a good question. This is a redone version of what I did this last year for Dharma's birthday, and I'm just redoing them and revising them and putting them up again. And last year I numbered them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. And if you look at the number of hits per post as you go along, the number starts high and goes down and down and down until eventually
it's
a very small number. Because basically people read something because they don't know what it is rather than that they do know what it is. And if you know what something is, even if you want to read it, you might think, oh, I know what that is. I'll read it later.
Right.
But if you don't know what it is, you read it now. In other words, you can't. Well, if the Harry Potter books were labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it probably wouldn't have been as good. So this year, this time around, I'm not numbering them. They look like individual, separate things. And there is more interest, and people are reading them more. Partly also because this is the bicentennial of his birth. And I think
right.
There's more interest. But yeah, when I numbered them last year, that was an utter failure. It went from some interest to just people not looking at them.
So you think, obviously, if you've written that, you've written all these pieces, you do think that Darwin should have his own day? Because I think that's fascinating. Darwin has a day.
Yeah, in fact, I am a little bit, I'm hoping no one here, and not too many people in the Twin Cities, hear what I'm about to say, but, we have a pretty major university here and a pretty big presence of biological people and an important natural history museum, and a local artist, by the way, who is a Lynn Feldman, who's kind of who does our talk radio show for Atheist Talk Radio here on Sunday mornings. She's like the Ira Flato of the Twin Cities. She interviews scientists, but she's an artist and has a big interest in involvement in science. Is the person who came from outside the university and came into the university several months ago and said, "What are you doing for Darwin's birthday?" And kind of made a push and managed to get a program at our local Natural History Museum, which will happen next week, that I'm involved in. That will be a celebration of Darwin. Otherwise, we're not really doing anything here. And it's astonishing to me, not only does she should have a day, but on his 200th birthday, it should be a whole year. And in Britain, they're doing that. I mean, there's big things going on in Britain all year about this. They're rebuilding the Beagle, and they're going to, sail around the world in it. I mean, it's kind of a big deal.
Really?
Yeah. The Beagle Project, you can find it on the web. They're rebuilding the boat, But here, we're just doing one day, and I think we should be doing the whole year. I think we should be doing a bigger thing. It's also, by the way, really amazing to me, as an American, that we're not doing anything for Lincoln's birthday. He was born the same day as Darwin.
I had no idea.
Yeah, Lincoln's like one of the big five. He's on the penny and the $5 bill, and he's on Mount Rushmore. There's a Lincoln monument. Why is there not a celebration for Lincoln's 200th birthday?
How does that get determined? Like, I'm not sure which people have holidays. I know there's Martin Luther King Day. I know there's a President's Day. Or is it just President's Day? Yeah, it's just President's Day, isn't it?
Well, in the U.S., it's done by government level. So every state can choose, for example, to have a holiday. So Martin Luther King has been adopted by states. Mm-hmm. I think mostly they're adopted by states, but it depends. I mean, in Boston, it just happens. It just happens that the British, when they occupied Boston at the time of the American Revolution, were forced out by the colonists on March 17th. So in Boston, that's called Evacuation Day. It's an official holiday, but it's actually also St. Patrick's Day. So, obviously it's always done for some specific reason, and different municipalities or states or the federal government can all, Congress can declare a holiday. But
is it something where, like the Atheist Bus Campaign, hypothetically, if if one started a campaign, could you influence, and eventually there would be a Darwin Day?
Yeah, I don't think there would be a Darwin Day in the United States because it conflicts with Lincoln's birthday, mm-hmm. and and because it will always be seen as too political.
But if it was like Darwin / Lincoln Day, you could pick. Anyway,
yeah, and I think, you know, the thing is, this, we don't really want a Darwin's Day. What we really want to do is want to fight for Darwin's Day.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's it's the resistance itself that matters.
That's interesting that you're talking about that, because there's a certain segment of the population that call people who accept evolution Darwinists, like it's just another religion. So
yes.
What's your perspective on that?
Well, I have sort of two completely opposite opinions on that. For one thing, I agree that it's sort of calling evolutionists, you know, the other term is evolutionist as opposed to creationist. You know, so again, it's sort of a belief system. And, you know, and I disagree with that. I think that you're basically a scientist, or maybe you're a biologist, or maybe you're just a rational person. And, or maybe even not so rational, but you happen to think that Darwin is interesting. But on the other hand, it's interesting to me that we don't have an equivalent person for other areas of science. Like, if you're interested in thermodynamics, you're not a Kelvinist or whatever, you know. If you're a physicist, you know, you're not a Newtonian or whatever.
Right.
And the reason for that is because these earlier scientists in those other fields, their work has largely, it's very important, but it's been eclipsed or completely turned over or changed significantly by some kind of quote-unquote paradigm shift. Whereas Darwin, the only time you hear a real biologist call them, say something like, oh, I'm not a Darwinist, is when they're being cute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're saying, oh, Darwin had this one particular way of thinking, and I have a slightly different way of thinking, therefore I'm not a Darwinist. But in fact, every single biologist is a Darwinist in a sense that, not that it's a religion, but in the sense that Darwin's fundamental contributions to biology are still valid. Nothing has happened since Darwin's origin that would change very much of what he said. You would add chapters. You wouldn't be throwing out too many things in the existing chapters. And most of the significant questions that he formulated, we are still addressing. So in that sense, I think it's kind of cool to call yourself a Darwinist, because we're saying that we've got this really big, complicated, hard-to-figure-out thing called biology, called life, and now we've been working on it, you know, for a long time, and Darwin was a key moment in the history of biology, and that was a long time ago, and we're still working on it because it's so rich, in, you know, difficult to understand, complex, you know, and so on. And at the same time, Darwin's ideas still basically are valid. And that's quite an impressive thing, that you have a scientist who writes something in 1859, well, and before and after, that is still the basic canon of what we're thinking is important. There's no other science that has anything like that. No other science is even close to the current research program and our current belief. Chemistry, you know, people believe certain things and they change their minds and they learn stuff, and eventually they got this periodic table of the elements a long time ago, and it's still the valid, you know, paradigm for chemistry. But people aren't really working on it anymore. They're working on other things in chemistry.
Okay,
but in biology, we basically think that the stuff Darwin said is pretty much right, and we're still addressing the questions that he raised.
Well, you mentioned that this is a complex issue, and I think that's why a lot of people have a problem wrapping their heads around it. You know, and I don't know if this question is going to be answerable, but what is evolution?
Yeah, okay.
That's I realize that's rather vague.
That is, okay, I can tell you there's actually a smart guy who was wrong about some important things, but also very smart about a lot of other things, called Ernst Mayr, who actually wrote a book called Darwin's Five Theories, and he has, I can never remember what all five of them are, but they're all the different, you know, in other words, if you wanted to break down evolution, there's a way to do it by looking at the different things Darwin said. And so one thing is that all life originated with a single original life form. That's a tenet of evolution. So evolution is beginning with a single life form. Another, the concomitant fact that goes along with that is that that diversification has happened and continues to happen. So, and this is a big deal for Darwin, that a species doesn't just sit there. It eventually gives rise to new species if it doesn't go extinct first. Diversification happens, okay? And the implication of those two is the other really important part of evolution, which is any living species, if you look into its past, changed over time. Some things didn't change for a long time, but as somewhere in the past, you're going to find change, maybe recently, maybe farther back. And then the other tenet of evolution, that's all evolution. But the one that people often associate most with Darwin, but he actually said all these things, is that evolutionary change proceeds under the influence of natural selection, which is a process whereby the condition under which things exist determines the degree to which certain genetic variants are passed on more frequently and others are passed on less frequently. And that's natural selection. So it's origin, it's a common origin, diversification, change over time, and natural selection are the four of the five theories. I can't remember what Mayer says the fifth one is, but I think it's like a version of one of those four.
Okay, I'm just going to give the callers a chance to phone in again. Sorry, callers, it's 492-2577, extension 1. Okay, Greg, so do the words evolution, survival of the fittest, and natural selection all mean the same thing?
Well, yeah, not exactly, because evolution, in a sense, means all those other things, too. It means change over time and not necessarily how it changed. So an organism can change over time because of random changes, for example, and that's not natural selection, okay? Where natural selection is the specific process whereby individuals produce more offspring than can survive, and the differential survivorship often is because of some trait that those individuals have, and that varies among them. So the most obvious example is an individual born with a genetic variant that doesn't allow it to reproduce. You know, no sperm, no egg can be produced or whatever, would be selected against. An organism born with a genetic variant that allows it to convert more energy from the environment into babies than other members of its own species will likely have a greater contribution to the future generations. That's natural selection. Survival of the fittest is a phrase that evolutionary biologists cringe when they hear it because it is often misunderstood. I don't think it's such a bad term, as long as you know what you mean when you say fittest. But people often take fit to mean something other than it is. This actually speaks to a really important fallacy people have, and that is to fail to distinguish between optimization and maximization. Okay? Fitness, evolutionary fitness, is this thing that is always maximized by natural selection. If there's anything that comes along that gives you more representation of genes in future generations, it will be selected for. Anything that gives you less will be selected against. So that's just an absolute amount of increase. Whereas the number of offspring you have, for example, is not increased. It's optimized. It's set at some level that works. So for some organisms, it's a small number per generation. Other organisms, it's a large number per generation.
So fittest means better adapted as opposed to stronger.
Yeah. It means two things. And for Darwin, fit, he used the word fit to talk about the degree of fit. The degree of, just imagine this nature being made up of shapes, you know, niches you can live in, and how well shaped you are to fit in that niche. There's a fit there. But we also use the word fitness today to literally mean the relative contribution of an allele, a particular allele, a variant of a gene, in the future generations relative to some other allele. So fitness is, the way we used to say, is always a relative measure among different versions of a given gene.
Okay, Greg, we have two callers on the line.
Good.
I'm just going to cut you off and put them on.
Actually, just one so far. The other one's in the queue.
Oh.
See what I did there?
Yeah, it was beautiful.
$5 if you guess who the first caller is.
Nathan.
Nathan. I know
Nathan.
There. Go, Nathan.
admittedly, I have not read Origin of Species, but I understand that Darwin chose not to examine human evolution as much as he did the animal kingdom. If you were to speculate, purely speculative, of course, what do you think Darwin would say about things like Neanderthals or Homo floresiensis?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is true that in the Origin, he didn't talk much about human evolution, and he actually talks about this in his autobiography. He talks about why he did that and didn't do that, and he was concerned that there would be a distraction away from his case if he talked about human evolution, but he felt it was important. And after he wrote the 600-page Origin, some years later, he wrote another book that was all about human evolution. So he actually did write about it, and he did a major contribution towards it. He did have, throughout his lifetime, the early hominids were found, and And he was aware of that, and he recognized that if you go back in geological time, you find things that look like humans, but they're different. And so that he saw that humans were just like other species, that there was a change in the fossil record over time. He further speculated that the closest living relatives to humans were the apes. And he looked at the Asian apes, and he looked at the African apes, and he chose the African apes as being more closely related to humans than the Asian apes correctly, and suggested that the split between apes and humans would have occurred a long time ago in Africa. So he basically, he didn't say a lot about the things that we see now. We know so many things now that he didn't know about, he couldn't have commented on, but what he did, and he also talked about sexual selection as being a factor in human evolution, which is very true, although I think we're only now beginning to understand a lot of that. And so he dealt with it quite a bit, and he got a lot of what he said right. He, however, had one idea, which was, we now know, really wrong. And one of the exciting, really exciting changes in how we think about human evolution is changing what Darwin said. When he said that the large brain and the freeing of the hands and the use of tools and the evolution of language all come together, that when you stand upright, you free your hands, and then you can use your hands for manipulating things, and your brain gets bigger because you're doing smarter technological things and language emerges and so on. But we now know that standing upright and the so-called freeing of the hands happened several million years before the brain changed its size at all. So he had to sequence. He had a sort of a co-evolutionary model of different traits in humans, and that's now we know that this is what happened. That our ancestors stood up straight, relatively. And then they actually started making stone tools, and then their brains got bigger way later. So it was, so that part, he was speculating, within the absence of any evidence, he was speculating and got it wrong.
Isn't that one of the beautiful things about science, though, when you get something wrong and you find the real answer?
Yes, and in fact, that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's actually one of the things about Darwin that people who don't read what he writes don't necessarily know, and that is, that was what he was all about. He was, his whole approach was to propose ideas and then prove them wrong. I mean, he was, you know, other people were kind of doing that kind of thing. I mean, Francis Bacon was doing that kind of thing. Charles Lyell was doing that kind of thing. But Darwin brought it to a new level where his whole point of making the arguments he made was to prove them wrong. And if you do that and do that and do that and do that, what's left after you're done doing that for a long time are ideas that are much better than the ideas you started out with. You know, and he explicitly talks about that in his writing, that his objective is to not go forward with an idea that he felt would not have the strength of argument and that would not last under the strength of argument. Okay.
Did that answer your question, Nathan?
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's very informative. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nathan.
We have another caller.
In a bit. Do you have a question for Greg while we do the switcheroo?
I do. Actually, I was wondering about, you mentioned the time scale of evolution. So what kind of time scale are we working with? Is this sort of a sudden thing, or is it sudden or long term, depending on which kind of discipline we're talking about?
You talk about the actual evolution of organisms and stuff? Is that what you mean?
Sort of. It's just there's so many different scientific fields that talk mm-hmm. about evolution in one way or the other.
Right.
So I'm wondering, you know, if you're talking about transitional fossils as opposed to organisms that are developing currently,
yeah,
or evolving currently.
That's actually also, that's a very good question. That's actually an area that is very exciting right now because there is a lot of open questions there. This is something that Darwin didn't know about, which is his idea was that there was diversification happening all the time among species. What he didn't know was actually there were long periods of time in any given fossil record of a given region where all the species that you see don't change at all, or not very much, for very long periods of time. And then suddenly they change a lot. And so this is this idea you've probably heard of called punctuated equilibria, where you have the way it probably works is that there are forces of nature that keep organisms from changing. And even though there's no obvious change happening, it's actually not happening because of evolutionary forces. Natural selection is maintaining the status quo.
Gotcha.
And then something happens and causes natural selection to stop maintaining the status quo. And maybe it's because it's shifting things in another direction, or maybe it's because it's so-called relaxed selection, we call it sometimes, like every organism is in the niche it's in because another organism is next to it eating, you know, a similar food but not identical food or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or if there's predators causing organisms to be kind of limited in their in certain features that are then go extinct, then it just opens things up and things can change and be kind of random for a while. And then when these selective forces come back again, things are now no longer random again, but everything has changed a little bit, and some and there's new species, and different species than there were before that have descended from the earlier ones. Darwin didn't know about that pattern, and today we don't know about that pattern. We now know that the fossil record shows us stasis punctuated by change, but we're not really sure why it happens that way. And we don't, you know, you'll hear people say, you know, if you go into a room of biologists and someone says, oh, it takes a couple million years for evolution to happen, no one, you know, people often say, oh, yeah, that's fine, that makes sense. But in fact, most species exist in the fossil record for about 2 million years on average. And the evolutionary changes that actually happen so fast that we don't see them happen in the fossil record at all.
Greg, we actually have two callers on the line.
Great.
We have Aaron, first of all. Aaron, are you still there?
Yep.
Go ahead, sir.
So I was wanting to clarify on the last question. Is there proof or evidence that evolution sort of happens in short spurts rather than over a long period of time?
Yeah, I think there is. Because it's something that can happen so quickly, it's hard to see it in the fossil record. So you can only find it in some places, but there are examples. We'll give you one example. A guy named Pete Williamson, who is actually a character in the Congo Memoir series on my blog, if you want to read some funny stories about scientists in the field, who studied snails. And what he found was that if you look at layer after layer after layer after layer, there'll be four or five species of snails consistently unchanging over time. And then you'll find a layer where all the things that tell you what species you're looking at get crazy. You can't tell. They're just changing rapidly, and they're overlapping, and they vary way more than they used to vary. And then the next layer above that, they're all nice, well-behaved species again for several more layers. But there are different species than that were there before. And the time frame in which that change happens in Peter Williamson's snails is less than 50,000 years. Hmm. And the time frames over which no change is happening is about 200,000 or 300,000 years.
Wow, that's very
interesting. That's an example. Yeah, and it's hard to say. Maybe they happen even faster than that, but it's about a 50,000-year time frame. We know that major climate changes cycle in about 40,000-year time frames in the last 2 million years. So you got to explain evolution in time frames that are that size.
So maybe it could be some large environmental change that's triggering this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly what it is. In the last 2 million years, it's the coming and going of ice ages. In previous times, it may have been different kinds of changes. And, of course, you have the occasional whopping big asteroid whacking into the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
That will, you know, that's a big environmental change.
Okay, and to go on to another thing, just to speculate a little bit. Darwin was talking about how standing upright frees the hands for tools, and it frees so you can do more intellectual things using
right.
tools, and it's then therefore expanding the mind. If in the future, do you see that an area where human experience could expand into, where maybe it hadn't been experienced previously, and this could influence our own evolution?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that's true. I think that the problem with evolutionary thinking in regards to this kind of question is when we look at the past and we look at things that happened over time in the past, we see a story for one species or another that makes total sense. But when we look at the future, we can't predict what the story is going to be. So it's very hard to speculate in this way. But we do know, for example, that right now, in the last 10,000 years, which is kind of a short time period, there's been a fairly large amount of evolution. People are arguing right now over how much there was and what it meant and so on. But there's been a fair amount of genetic change. And one thing that we know is that we're pretty sure that if you measure brain sizes over the last maybe 30,000 years, there's been two significant changes in brain size that have happened. And one of them was something like maybe 30,000 years ago, a little more. And the other one was about 10,000 years ago. And they're both reductions in brain size. Brain size
okay.
is down. Yeah. And I think there might be another one happening now. And, you know, part of the reason is because as society changes, people become specialized and their expertise is less, generalized expertise is less. What do you need to survive in a, as a North American, you know, Western person? What do you need? You need to use a microwave. You need to know where the TV clicker is.
So
beyond
possibly,
that, it's not that hard. So, but if you're a hunter-gatherer, you need to know a lot of stuff, and that requires being smart, having a large brain, and so on. But I think that we have a future that's going to definitely have changed because of the kind of technology that we use for communication and so on.
Mm-hmm, because there are people out there who use their brains to their fullest capacities than other people who are just not doing that.
Yeah, so, and the thing is that the amount, you know, what it gets you, you have to ask the question, what does it get you from an evolutionary point of view? You know,
well, thank you for answering.
Yeah.
Thank you, caller.
No problem.
And
we're going to go to a break.
We
and,
will be.
Look, we're trying to finish the same sentence. I'm going to let Heather talk.
Oh, I want us to both do it. It's fun when we talk in unison. We're going to play an ad, and then we will be right back. One moment.
This is Desiree, one of the hosts of Q Transmissions, Edmonton's only skeptical call-in talk show. Next episode, we'll be talking to Dr. Anton Capri about quantum physics. Do you know anything about quantum physics? Well, neither do we. So can we really use energy to cure diseases, quit smoking, and make our mothers love us? Let's see what the evidence says. So put down that Deepak Chopra book and tune into the next Q Transmissions every Friday at 6 p.m. here on CJSR.
Hello, we are back, and we have Brownian on the line. Go ahead, Brownian.
Oh, hi. First of all, as a reader of your blog, Dr. Layden, it's great to hear you in person.
Oh, great. Glad you must be my 12th reader. I thought I had only 11 readers. But
sorry, what was that?
I thought I only had 11 readers. I now know I have 12 readers. Great.
That's
I'm sure you have more than that. Basically, what I wanted to ask about was about the politicization of the evolution creationism debate, and particularly when we push for things, when we push for things such as Darwin's Day and those sorts of celebrations, given that we don't celebrate other major scientists' birthdays or their contributions, at least in terms entrenched in some sort of holiday, as much as I'd like to see that, don't we run the risk of alienating maybe not those that are comfortable with their religious beliefs and evolution, but those who see evolution as a threat to their beliefs? And that particularly if we elevate Darwin as somebody, it fits into their mindset that maybe we're worshiping on some level, and that becomes very threatening. So is it possible that by pushing for these sorts of celebrations that we're actually pushing away those individuals that if they were to understand the theory, see that it doesn't really conflict necessarily with their beliefs, or even if it does, it certainly doesn't conflict with the evidence?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's a really important question, because in this whole discussion, there is a subtext about how you approach the problem. I should mention, I think tonight or tomorrow, the press releases are going to be coming out for a new book by Eugenie Scott at the National Center for Science Education on Evolution and Creationism, The Debate. And it's her revised edition of her earlier book. And in the U.S., the National Center for Science Education is kind of a center for dealing with this debate from the evolutionary perspective. And they are concerned about the kind of issue you just brought up sometimes. I'm not sure that they would be against the Darwin Day, but they play a role in which they are trying to be the kind of the nice guys when it comes to having this debate. They'll be tough in the courtroom. They'll be tough in the schoolroom. We're drawing a line. We're not appeasing. We're not going to compromise about whether or not religion should be taught in the classroom. It should not be. And creationism is religion, period, is all there is to it. But on the other hand, if people want to go out and read, you know, Ken Miller's book and reconcile their Catholicism with their Darwinism, they can do that. And then on the farther left side, if you will call it left, you have people like P.Z. Myers, who are very radical atheists, and who will say, to answer your question, P.Z. would say, those people should be driven away from this debate. We don't want to talk to them. And they're not going to be part of the picture. They're only going to turn on us later and so on, and which I just sort of, I'm going to leave in that direction too. But you do have to kind of realize that I think that what happens is you'll have people who are on the far more radical end of this and people who are in the middle of it. And we all know each other. And we all get together and we have a beer or something and talk about these things. And we never debate those issues. We never debate the issue internally as to how far to go and whether to push or not push, because I think everyone knows you've got to do both. You've got to have people being kind of in the middle, people being kind of ready to compromise a little bit, and you have to have people on the extreme end, because if you don't have people on the extreme end on your side, the other side does, and the center moves away from you, in a sense. So that's a pragmatic answer. That's a sort of a cop-out pragmatic answer to your question, I think. But also keep in mind, and I'm not sure about all the Canadian holidays, but in the U.S., we have New Year's, which is a secular holiday. Then we have Christmas, working backwards through the year, which is a religious holiday. You know, pretend we have a nondescript holiday, but and there's Hanukkah, which is widely celebrated. And, you know, Kwanzaa has religious overtones. So there's right around there, 3 out of 4 holidays. Thanksgiving is an American holiday. The American version of Thanksgiving is secular, but technically it's religious. Thanksgiving means praying thanks to God for we survived the winter as the pilgrims, who were religious fanatics. And we have Easter. So if I think a person complaining or was worried about Darwin being sort of, you know, a secular thing being worshipped, I think it's valid to point out, well, we've got other religions. We've got Ramadan, we've got Hanukkah, and we've got, you know, Christmas. We can have Darwin Day, too.
Did that answer your question, caller?
Yes, it does. To place myself in this background, I'm a frequent contributor to Fringula, so I put myself in the militant atheist camp. Mm-hmm. But I do recognize that there are a lot of students, particularly young religious students, kind of coming in who, exposed to a paleontology class would have no problem once they've seen the evidence, once they've understood the theory of accepting that. I guess it's just how much are we putting blinders on them, or at least hardening them against it, if they're worried, oh no, if I buy into this theory, that means that I must be a Darwin worshiper and I'm clearly going to go to hell or so on and so forth. But I guess I certainly see the perspective as well of having individuals on all sides of the spectrum, particularly people like Ken Miller and that, who do have bona fide religious credentials as well as being staunch supporters of the theory.
Perfect. Yeah. Thanks very much for calling.
Oh, thank you.
And callers, again, 492-2577, extension 1. All right, some good calls here. Speaking of creationists, I guess, Greg, can you try and explain to me why exactly creationists have such a problem with evolution? Because, you know, I vaguely understand, but from also what I understand, evolution doesn't even try to explain how life started in the first place. It focuses, you know, on adaptation and changes in already existing life forms.
Okay, there's a can of worms there that we can just touch on briefly, and that is evolution actually does explain the origin of life. And as a biologist, I have to stand, you know, shoulder to shoulder with my brothers and sisters in the origin of life field, because there are scientists studying that, and I don't want to say we can let a religious sensibility exclude that research from the protection against religious death. You know what I mean? So we do actually approach that. I just said, you know, it's not the origin of life is probably, although this might not be true, the origin of life study is not going to cure cancer. So therefore, you know, it's not funded that well. So If everybody worked on this problem for 10 years, we'd solve it. You know, but right now there's only a few people doing it. But there's different answers to this question of where does the creationism come from, and it depends upon who the creationist is. And one thing I think needs to be understood is that there are people who are religious activists and political activists who believe, I think, that it's a cultural issue that you need to have Christian religion in the public square, mm-hmm. in the classroom, on the money, in the courthouse, in the city hall, on the Christmas decorations of the green, and so on, because that is the iconographic manifestation of the political right wing. Not because they believe in God, not because it's the right thing to do from a religious point of view or whatever. It's a politically motivated thing. And a relatively small number of people who are politically motivated in that sense have set up this game where you convince a lot of other people that this has to happen for religious reasons. Okay? And in truth, the vast majority, and 20 years ago in the United States, the vast majority of people who would count themselves as Christians were not concerned about evolution.
Mm-hmm.
they were raised to believe in school that there are conflicts between science and religion, and you're going to find out about those when you get to the pearly gates. And it's not something that we humans can actually contemplate. The idea that there's always been people who felt that, that evolution was a threat to their religion, and it's ever since Darwin and, you know, before. But it has grown recently as a political tool. So those kids who go into the classrooms, in biology classrooms, with Bibles in their hands, and contribute to the creation of science fairs and those kind of things are absolute pawns in a political game that really has very little to do with religion.
Well,
and,
actually, that's interesting.
I wish people would understand that.
I found a handy questions to ask your biology teacher list, and it's all about evolution, and it was on one of the creation sites that I was looking at. And if you don't mind, I'd like just maybe can you explain some of these questions? Because one of the things that they mention is the Cambrian explosion, in which all major animal groups appear together in the fossil record fully formed. So why are they saying that's proof of creation as opposed to evolution?
Well, if it was true, the reason
nice segue.
Is it's because you would expect a different pattern. You'd expect there to be like a single cell organisms that and then evolve into a small number of different multicellular organisms and then diversify into more multicellular organisms. You expect there to be over a period of time a range of, you know, a slow, steady evolutionary change. What we actually have is there's several things that actually explain the Cambrian explosion, and one of them is it's not really there. The Cambrian itself is divisible into distinctly different time periods that are really far apart in time from each other. So it's compressing many things at one time. And then before the Cambrian explosion, I think there's now believed to be documented 5 or 6, you know, times and places in the past where there are lots of organisms that are different. So the Cambrian explosion is an artifact of the literature, and it's also an artifact of the reality of preservation, because some of the things that happened in the Cambrian explosion was some organisms evolved more hard parts that were preserved. So if all life appeared simultaneously with no precursors whatsoever, and it was multicellular complex life, if that really happened, that would be hard to explain from a scientific point of view. But it didn't happen.
Okay, that's one. Thank you. actually, I think some of the misinformation that's being presented on creationist websites, some of it can, you know, if you were going to be charitable, it could be attributed to just simple ignorance of science. But some of them are just exceptionally interesting. Like the human footprints being found next to dinosaur footprints, for example.
The Paluxy footprints. These are footprints in a Texas site. There's a few sites, but the famous one is Paluxy, Texas. And there's a set of human. They're supposed to be human-looking footprints, you know, in the same mud that dinosaur footprints are in. And if you looked at that, it is kind. They do kind of look kind of like human footprints. But if you follow the tracks, it turns out that there is a dinosaur that leaves those tracks, and it's just that those tracks are incomplete and imperfect. And there's actually some spots where you can follow the tracks, and they transform from the human into the dinosaur or back, whatever. And then that's basically a lie. And what I find interesting there is that one of the things on that list is Piltdown, that evolutionists make up stuff.
Right.
And, you know, Piltdown was a hoax, and it was a travesty, but, you know, that's actually not so bad. We had one. I mean, look at the banking industry. look at everybody else. Everybody and everything else, journalism, art, you know, like fake art, every other human endeavor has dozens, hundreds, even thousands. When we get to religion, tens of thousands of cases where people make stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And in biology, we have one. Well, there's two, because there's also two or three. But every time it happens, we find out who did it, and we fall upon them and consume their livid flesh. I mean, no one in science survives making stuff up. And for very long. But every other endeavor, you know, outside of science, people are doing it all the time.
Well, I find that really interesting because, like, another thing that they keep talking about is how, well, why haven't we seen any new species develop? But I remember a while back reading the study about the E. coli.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Do you want to explain that really briefly?
Well, I'm not sure which study you were talking about exactly, but there are cases of, just to answer the question more generally, there's actually some time ago, 50 years ago on TalkOrigins.com, which is a pre-internet, you know, discussion group. There was a list made by a bunch of scientists, and it still stands today, and it's been growing. And at that time, it was 200 examples of speciation at the present time. And the thing is, I actually calculated out at one time how much time we've had scientifically observing the planet and how many observers that are recording information, how many observing hours there were of people observing things in nature that we would then see in that record of observation an evolutionary event of some species changing before our eyes compared to the overall record of how many species there are and how much speciation happens. And we're actually pretty much right on. We have seen speciation happen in a very small amount, and we would expect to see it in a very small amount over the small time we've been looking. But it was like 200 examples, and many of them are insects, and many of them are plants that happen to evolve a little faster than some other organisms do. But we've seen plenty of speciation outside of the laboratory, in the wild, and a lot of examples in the laboratory. But also, the fossil record is pretty good. I mean, you can see it happening. I mean, I have dug up four tusk elephants in Africa, you know, and they look just like the two tusk elephants, but with four tusks. And, you know, there's obviously change. You can look at the individual bones, and you can see as you go through the layers, they change. You know, I've heard about the most recent interesting reported find is the whale from Pakistan. They found a female and a male of the same species of a proto whale. So this thing has flipper like hands and, you know, arm flipper like feet, and it lives in the water. Has fishy eating teeth, but there was a fetus in the female that is pointed head out. And an underwater aquatic species would probably be born tail first.
Right.
This thing looks like it's be born head first. So it comes up on land to give birth, but it lives in the sea. And if you look at the bones of this thing, there's other species that are older and other species that are later, and you can see the progression from one to the next. And the earlier species are quadrupedal land animals, and the later species are whales. So, you know, I don't think we need to see a lot of evolution happen before our eyes. The fossil record is just loaded with it.
Right.
But, you know, it is hard to see. We've only been looking for a couple of centuries, and there's only been several tens of thousands of people looking, and there's, you know, millions and millions and millions of species, and evolution, speciation is mostly not happening. Remember, you know, it's mostly stasis, and every once in a while it happens in all the species at once. It's like the famous creationist argument, which is actually in a YouTube video now, which the guy opens a jar of peanut butter and says, aha, there's only peanut butter here. You know, if evolution was real, eventually someone would open up the jar of peanut butter and there'd be a new species in there.
Very, very
and
nicely put.
Yet. Well, I don't know. With our latest problems from Georgia and peanuts, I think that may have been disproven.
And we're almost out of time, so I have one last question. I recently interviewed P.Z. Myers, and I asked him a question that maybe comes stock in my interviews. Do you have a theme song?
Do I have a theme song?
Mm-hmm, like something that plays in your head when you're walking down the street?
No, I don't really.
Oh, come on. He had the Imperial Death March.
He had the Imperial Death March. That's funny. He had that question prepared. No, my theme song is Galileo by the Indigo Girls.
Wonderful. Nice choice.
I wish we had that on tap. On tap, you know.
Well, thank you very much, Greg, for being with us. This has been great.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
So again, everybody, Darwin Day events are happening at the U of A. Check our blog after the show for more details. Also, you can check out Greg's blog. There's going to be a link on our blog after the show. And check our blog for everything. Every piece of information that you need is there. Have a good night, everyone.
The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. The hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie. Lie.
Everything you believe.
There are wee tiny dwarfs inside your TV,
and nobody cares when you cry.
Your mother resents you. She wanted a girl,
and everything you believe is a lie.
Been years, but I never loved you, and time never will,
though I've tried.